There was a man who worked for the post office. His job was to process all the mail with illegible addresses on them, handwriting too hard to read. And on an ordinary day, this happened to be near Christmas time, a letter came across his desk, simply addressed in shaky, uneven handwriting, "To God." And he felt a sense of urgency. This could be a life crisis. We had better attend to this right away. And he opened the letter to God and read, "Dear God, I'm an 83-year-old widow living on a very small pension. Yesterday, someone stole my purse. It had my last $100 in it, all the money I had until my next pension check. Next Sunday is Christmas, and I have invited my only two friends for dinner. Without that money, I have nothing to buy food with. I have no family to turn to. You are my only hope. Please help." And the letter was unsigned. The postal worker was so touched, and he called his colleagues around and shared the letter with them, and they too were quite moved. And with hardly being asked, they all dipped into their pockets and their purses, and within minutes they had raised $95. And the postal worker put that into an envelope. He paid attention to the return address on the first one, and he prepared it to return back to this dear woman in such dire straits. And you know, they all felt so good the rest of that day, and all through the week they felt they had partaken of someone else's situation, and they felt they had purpose, and that they had done such a good thing. They were so pleased. And then, soon after, a letter came back across the fellow's desk, and once again, in that shaky handwriting, it said, "To God." And he called everybody over and read aloud, "Dear God, how can I ever thank you enough for what you did for me? Because of your gift, I was able to have a glorious dinner for my friends. Such a nice Christmas. I told my friends of your wonder and your love." And she added, "P.S., there was $5 missing. It must have been those crooks at the post office." The point is that we see what we choose to see, what we want to see, in the world and in ourselves, in other people, though we often cannot perceive what is truly taking place before us. We categorize one another, we make assumptions based on those categories, we project all sorts of expectations and betrayal upon those people we do not actually know, people we are perhaps afraid to actually, truly know. Not all, but most of us do this, and we usually get away with it. Zoologist Wolfgang Schlite studies turkeys. He notes how mother turkeys, just like so many other mothers, intuitively protect their young from predators in the wild. Rats and weasels are known to raid nests, and mother turkeys must be ever alert, and they will attack just about anything that moves, unless it sounds like a baby turkey. Dr. Schlite encountered a mother turkey inexplicably pecked her babies to death. And eventually he discovered that Mama Turkey was deaf. She could not hear the cry of her young. In her confusion, she was in effect defending her offspring from themselves. And in doing so, she killed them. Mother Turkey, acting only from instinct, destroyed her children because she could not hear them. And this illustrates for us both appropriate defensive behavior and the tragic consequences of that same behavior misapplied. Overlay this cause and effect on conflicts occurring in our lifetime. Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda, Serbs, Croatians, and Muslims, Albanians in Kosovo, and perennially, it seems, the tribes of the Middle East. And closer to home, consider the conflicts involving the Black Lives Matter movement, the Confederate flag, gun laws, white supremacy, and sadly, so much more. Fixated on differences and blind and deaf to commonalities, human instinct can cloud human reason. Disillusioned by fear and hatred and pride, warriors far and near recognize the discernible fear before them, but they cannot seem to recognize the discernible kinship also before them. In the name of superior ancestry, lineages, or race, common people can be commanded by those with influence and power to live with uncommon fear and kill the predator approaching the shared nest. Throughout civilization, like the mother turkey never hearing the cries of her dying children, for the sake of survival, lives have been lost in rage and slaughter by mistaken human perceptions. And we don't like to acknowledge how we ourselves, how many degrees are we apart from behavior we might consider savage when persuaded to see only enemies. I dare say all of us in varying degrees possess some measure of distrust and some capacity for attack. Most of us are capable of responding when our nest is threatened. Again, for the sake of survival, there is legitimate need for this ability because there are, of course, real predators in the world. But also, for the sake of our survival, we must temper this response, however natural, and create systems and follow morals that heed that which and those who beckon us toward our greater humanity. To master knee-jerk suspicion, we must cultivate a companion capacity for peace and understanding. But what do disciplined love, deaf turkeys, and ethnic conflict have to do with us this morning? Have to do with religion, for that matter? The influential Unitarian minister A. Powell Davies, of a few generations back, wrote, "We now know that every one of the religions is both true and false, right and wrong, and what is deeply true in any one of them is just as true in all of them. Every one of the great religions, in one form or another, give us the golden rule. They tell us that we cannot live by bread alone, that greed and cruelty destroy those who practice it, and that justice in the long run cannot be denied, that love is better than hate, and that we must come together at last to brotherhood and sisterhood. And they all speak, and they all speak in their differing accents of the living spirit who dwells in the innermost mystery, whom some leave nameless and others call God." Again from Unitarian minister A. Powell Davies. Well, of course, intellectually, we already knew that. But we are no less susceptible to hasty assessment and rash judgment. In moments of anxiety or fear, we allow ourselves to protect our suspicion, of mysterious others who simply are different from ourselves. When someone articulates a viewpoint or shares a belief counter to what we have experienced, we allow ourselves to draw conclusions about their motives rather than subjecting ourselves to the spiritual discipline of hearing what they have to say, reflecting what we heard them say, stating where and how honest differences may exist, and indeed they will, and also where common ground might be found. Instead, we can be suspicious of the motives of those we consider unlike us And it is on this low level that prejudice begins. Where might remediation begin? At the risk of oversimplifying, what overcomes suspicion is love. What overcomes trite and presumptive chatter is a call to real conversation and dialogue. What overcomes the instinctive apprehension that cannot hear is to intentionally hear, to listen to the other truly. Theologian Carter Hayward writes, quote, "We are not automatic lovers of selves, others, world, or God. Love does not just happen. Love is a choice, not simply or necessarily a rational choice, but rather a willingness to be present to others without pretense or guile. Love is a conversion to humanity, a willingness to participate with others in the healing of a broken world and broken lives. Love is the choice to experience life as a member of the human family, a partner in the dance of life, rather than as in an alien world or as a deity above the world, aloof and apart from human flesh." Love is a choice, says Hayward. Love is a choice, a conversion to humanity. Theologian Reinhold Niebuhr says, to love as standing in the place of the other, the relation between persons in which one individual penetrates another. Standing in the place of the other imaginatively and sympathetically. Niebuhr was interested in personal as well as societal morality and the ways we rely upon systems and structures to mediate the two. Now, we can debate whether religious bodies are the worst structures or only the worst until compared with all others. I do believe, though, that a primary task of any community of faith, any house of worship, must be this imaginative penetration into the mystery of the other. We are still going to be human beings when we cross the threshold of a place such as this, and we will bring with us our greatest strength and our greatest weaknesses. So should we not at least here try to meet with imagination rather than with ambitions of domination? Can this larger process, through which the world might yet be saved, begin here among every one of us? There may be really only one subtle difference between friends and enemies, and this difference is not perfect behavior. It is rather imperfect forgiveness, because friends forgive each other. Whenever human beings live together, we are going to hurt one another eventually. Because we fail to hear, we peck at each other in moments of insecurity. We imagine enemies where there are none. And succumbing to blind and deaf instinct, we act defensively with the capacity to hurt. And then when the damage is done and the dust has settled and the doors are slammed shut, we are left to decide just what kind of people we are. And if we decide we are friends and live within the consequences of that decision, it will be easier to forgive one another. Friendship does not negate the base of our humanity, nor does it necessarily elevate us to an enlightened superhumanity. Friends within this fellowship and within the community and beyond, accept us for who we are, and, perhaps more important, forgive us for who we are not. Now, this all brings me to Ben. Some 20 years back, I was preaching before the small congregation in Jefferson City, the rural state capital of Missouri. And at some point in time there, the children of the church had studied the principles and purposes of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. Now, I digress a bit, but I will tell you that I am not the best spokesperson for the purposes and principles. As one raised with many religious rules, too many, I tend to shrink from any list, even one as hopeful and optimistic as the UUA list. They all strike me a little too close to creedal. I am, if you will, humbled because the children in the religious education program in Jefferson City, Missouri, gave me pause to reconsider all I just said. They were studying the purposes and principles, I imagine a common activity in our religious education programs, and they had translated the statements into their own languages, their own phrases, which were then posted on colorful paper and placed on a large wall of the fellowship's meeting place. And one placard read, "We believe that every person is important. We believe that every person is important," written and posted boldly for all to see, to define something important about that fellowship. But under this statement, in a decidedly different handwriting and with a differently colored marker, someone had written, "Including Ben." Now, I love that, and I did then what you do now. Can't help but wonder about Ben. Just what had he done to cause someone to write that? Perhaps he wrote it himself. Why was that special clause added apparently just for him? And that's really all I know of Ben, but I think I relate to him even still today. I think I might have been Ben a few times myself. Despite my crankiness over the denominational list, I do want to cultivate more love in my own heart. I do want to be part of a large circle. I want to encourage high trust and regard for everyone, including Ben. A few moments ago, I said that love overcoming suspicion was a simplification. Well, shame on me for that, you know, because perhaps it is that simple, or can be. Not easy, mind you. There is a difference between what is simple and what is easy, because making the choice for love is a simple but hard thing to do. But we must ever remember the lessons of love, and we must learn to love Ben, whoever Ben is to us, and in whatever ways he may at times be rather unlovable. Think about that a moment. Whose name might you insert? Don't say that out loud, because your Ben might be sitting right beside you. We need reminders, sometimes, of simply how to regard one another. I'm here today with my son Harrison, who is a freshman over at Upstate. And I recall back, I believe, in September during orientation, students and parents had been together for most of the day, and then they were separated. And the dean of students spoke to parents. And she said, "Right now, in another part of campus, your children are being read the Spartan Rule. And they are being told what our code of conduct is, what our expectations are, and just what it means to be part of this community." And she said, "And you all are not off the hook, because we have another full day together, and sometimes even parents need to be told how to behave. So I don't want to see any jostling at the coffee line. I don't want to see anybody rushing ahead for the bathroom. I want to see politeness and order when we ask questions. Because," she said, "because in about 4 years, some of y'all are gonna be related." And wouldn't that be embarrassing? To have offended your future, you get the idea. But fill in the blank about Ben. Who is Ben to you? How might you be Ben? My faith might be deeper, my heart might be fuller, my life might be richer if I could better understand everyone, including who is it that approaches your nest, whose cries you may not be hearing, whom you are already ready to attack. Whom do you regard as an enemy? Whom have you chosen not to love? And are these our only options? And what are we going to do about it? If we are to survive as congregations, as families, and God knows, as a nation, as a species, we must learn to make every effort to hear and to receive one another in love, even when we are given poor or no models. We must learn to penetrate imaginatively and sympathetically into the lives of others, including Ben. We will still at times have to forgive each other, because in a moment of weakness, of animal instinct, we may allow ourselves to see an enemy where there is a potential friend. And we cannot undo such behavior. But we can resist repeating it. We can work to not carry it forward into the future. Remember the difference between a friend and an enemy is not perfect behavior or any inherent value or quality. The difference between an enemy and a friend, the first difference, is forgiveness for you and for me, for everybody really, and one more time, including Ben. May it be so, and amen.